From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the Supreme Court handed a big win to abortion rights advocates on a case out of Louisiana. The 5-4 ruling strikes down a Louisiana law that required doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. Here's Louisiana State Senator Katrina Jackson, a Democrat who originally spearheaded the legislation, criticizing today's decision.
I am disappointed that today's Supreme Court decision strikes down Louisiana common sense law that I authored to protect women injured in abortion facilities. I am proud to be a pro-life Democrat. I am proud that this law received overwhelming support by both women and men, Democrats and Republicans, black legislators and white legislators.
Well, that Louisiana law never went into effect. The justices who struck it down today say it violated abortion rights outlined in the landmark 1973 Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. Joining us now is Elise Hogue, president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America. Elise, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
And first, your response to this ruling from the Supreme Court. What was at stake from your point of view?
Well, it was the only appropriate thing to do, given that the court had handed down a decision on an identical case out of my home state of Texas about 4 years ago. If they had actually ruled in the opposite direction, it would not only have cut off abortion access in the state of Louisiana, but it would have been striking down very recent precedent, and I think throwing the legitimacy of the court into question.
Well, you rightly point out that the case out of Louisiana was very, very similar to that case in Texas in 2016. So because of that, were you optimistic going into this ruling?
No, mostly because we know that since Trump was able to appoint two justices who he said the qualifying criteria was opposition to Roe, that they could have reversed themselves. We felt like it was crucially important to stay vigilant, to stay loud, to make sure people knew what was at stake, and essentially that Chief Justice Roberts knew that we were watching.
I know you heard Katrina Jackson there, the Democrat from Louisiana, who said this was a mistake. You know, your response to lawmakers there in that state and others who say that the law would have protected patient safety, the safety of women.
Yeah, every shred of data and evidence points to the contrary, which is why the court decided in the opposite in Whole Women's Health in 2016. In fact, it showed all research shows that public health of women is compromised when you restrict access to abortion, not the other way around. And in fact, these targeted laws at abortion providers are ideologically driven and have nothing to do with the health and well-being of women.
You mentioned the makeup of the court with new conservative judges. Of course, people have been watching this term very closely because of that. Once again, we see the Chief Justice John Roberts siding with liberal justices in this abortion case. Just tell me more about that. Your reaction to Chief Justice Roberts.
I mean, it's clear, you know, we're still sifting through what's quite a long written decision. But what is immediately clear is that this was done on very narrow grounds, and it leaves the door open to chipping away and eroding the basic fundamental reproductive freedoms of women and pregnant people. It is absolutely true that I think the Chief Justice was concerned about his own legacy and the legitimacy of the court if it had gone the other direction. But in no way do I think this makes us safe. In fact, you know, we know that ultimately we have to change the makeup of the Senate in order to reflect what most Americans believe in, which is legal access to abortion. Most Americans believe this is a decision for women and their families and not for politicians to meddle in. And we need a court that upholds precedent, upholds human rights, and upholds reproductive freedom. We're only going to get that with a Senate that reflects the will of the majority.
In fact, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote in a dissent that Roe, referring to Roe v. Wade, is grievously wrong for many reasons. So what's next on your radar in terms of attempts to get at this again?
Yeah, I mean, I think state legislatures and red states have become increasingly both sly about how they do this and also quite overtly hostile to Roe along the lines of Clarence Thomas. I think we've got our work cut out for us from a legal perspective and a political perspective because while today was a reprieve, I in no way think that this means that they are not out to undo these fundamental freedoms that are for the safety and well-being of American women. And we're not going to stop until those rights are considered sacrosanct.
So what other laws are you looking at right now that you are concerned about?
Absolutely. I think we're looking at two sort of different kinds of laws that attempt to make abortion completely inaccessible for people who need it. One are the straight up abortion bans, which swept the nation after Justice Kavanaugh was put on the court because the anti-choice movement believed it was the time to take on Roe directly. We saw those in a dozen states, most recently in Louisiana, sitting on Governor Bill Lee's desk to sign. And then on the other side, we have the sort of more incrementalist, more Justice Roberts approach, which is how do we do a death by a thousand cuts? How do we actually extend waiting periods? How do we make it harder for clinics to operate? How do we make it harder for women to get to clinics? And that has the same effect. A right without access is not a right at all.
That's Elise Hoge, president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America, on today's Supreme Court ruling. Elise, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, let's turn now to the conversations about police brutality and racial equity that are taking place in nearly every area of the country, with rural communities no exception. Sydney Bowles of the Ohio Valley Resource takes us to Whitesburg, Kentucky, a tiny Appalachian town that recently found itself in the middle of its own racial reckoning.
Terry Adams is the Letcher County Judge Executive, the county's highest elected official. In a recent Facebook post, he called Black Lives Matter, quote, a nonsense issue, and said racism didn't exist in Letcher County. The people playing the race card were the real racists, he wrote, and the protesters had an underlying agenda. His post caused an outcry. People argued viciously in the comments section, defending Black lives, defending Confederate statues, disputing whether the looting was justified. So when dozens of people filed into the courtroom for the next county fiscal court meeting, Judge Executive Adams had a pretty good idea what they were there for.
I'll start by saying that I suppose a lot of y'all are here because of a Facebook post I put on Facebook.
19-year-old Deja Hogg approached the lectern, looked Judge Adams right in the face, and spoke.
I know COVID's going on right now, so just imagine there's no COVID, normal society, and imagine that you walk around and it's like, you have to play.
Hogg is biracial, and Adams and every other county magistrate is white. Hogg gripped the lectern to steady herself and continued.
People look at you, and it's almost as if they stare too long, they breathe the same air, they're scared they're going to catch the plague. That is just a small, small glimpse of what it was like growing up here in Eastern Kentucky as a minority.
Letcher County is 95% white. Donald Trump got 80% of the vote in 2016. But it's also home to a progressive community that hosts drag and punk shows. It's got a solar-powered fire department and a thriving arts scene. There are layers of complexity that often get lost in media coverage of Trump country and also in the polarized landscape of social media. Residents Tanya Turner, Nate Thompson, and Michella Phipps also spoke at the county meeting.
You made a lot of assumptions in that post. You assumed that none of us lived here. A man who was asking for my votes 2 years ago.
Anyone can say, well, I'm not racist. But at that point, then I have to ask him, do you really know what racism is?
Seeing people murdered on video, it's not just a problem somewhere else. There have been black murders in Letcher County. And if you think otherwise, then you don't know our history.
Judge Adams looked uncomfortable as he listened to each speaker. He had tears in his eyes. When I spoke to him in his office a few days later, on Juneteenth, he said the blowback was a learning experience.
There's discrimination in about everything, really. I'm finding out that, you know, though it ain't as prominently, you don't really see it, I'm sure they are, racism.
Adam says he's sorry if he had hurt anyone.
I didn't realize there's as much tension locally as they are. I should not have brought what's national, going on nationally, and combined it with people wanting to speak out locally.
But Deja Hogg says that's exactly why she's fighting. To convince people like Judge Adams that her experience in Whitesburg is connected to the experiences of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, whose killing sparked a nationwide reckoning. It's connected by the same forces that shape so much of Appalachian life: resource extraction, poverty, and being looked down on by outsiders.
So race kind of just gets swept under the rug, which is where you get the institutionalized racism.
Hogg doesn't know if Judge Adams really gets it, but she says the conversation was still productive.
You know, this little town is making big moves, just like all these other places.
For now, Hogg says, that feels like justice. For Here and Now, I'm Sydney Bowles in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
And her story is part of the America Amplified Initiative, a national public media collaboration focused on community engagement reporting. Last night, President Trump retweeted that video of a supporter yelling white power at Black Lives Matter protesters, adding a thank you to the great people who support me. Well, his aides say Trump didn't hear the white power part. That's a white supremacist slogan. Here's the tape. Then there are those reports that a special Russian military unit paid bounties to Taliban fighters to kill American soldiers in Afghanistan. The president says he was not briefed on that because the Pentagon didn't think it was credible, which sounds incredible. But also, where's the condemnation of President Putin? Yesterday, Vice President Pence reversed his sunny language on COVID-19 and came out with a plea for Americans to wear masks as cases skyrocket in Texas and Florida. But that drew attention to the fact that the president doesn't wear a mask. And polls show a majority of Americans agree with protesters that there is systemic racism in the U.S. that needs to be addressed, as President Trump refers to those protesters as thugs. Is this a president out of step with Americans? And if so, what must it be like in this White House? Let's bring in New York Times White House correspondent Maggie Haberman. Maggie, so you have high virus numbers, low polling numbers. You speak directly to people in the White House. What is going on there?
I think that the president is alternately showing people that he is aware that he has enormous problems right now electorally. I'll put aside policy for the time being. He is aware that he has huge problems electorally and tells people that he knows there are some changes that need to be made. And then in the next conversation, he will be sanguine and happy and sound as if everything is fine and the sun is always shining in Trump land. So I think what's going on is you have a president whose advisors broadly question whether he wants the second term, whether he is actually trying to win right now. In terms of the COVID cases, I thought that admission from President Pence, while it wasn't framed that way, it was just telling people to wear a mask, which should be pretty uncontroversial. But given that it was the exact opposite of what he had said, or at least something he wouldn't say when he was at the briefing podium at HHS a few days ago, I thought it was pretty striking. And I think it's a real reflection of events spiraling potentially again out of control in relation to COVID, a virus that the White House had tried to signal for weeks now was on its way out. That's just clearly not the case. In terms of the story about GRU backing Afghanistan troops' attacks on U.S. troops, there were a number of people within the White House who were caught off guard by the story that does not relate to whether the president was briefed or not. Our reporting is that he was, and that it was in the presidential daily brief. The president reacted very angrily to that. But again, his reaction is about himself. He reacted about the part about what he knew, not about his reaction to this information. And I think that you are going to see much more attention focused on the substance of the story and not the specific of whether the president was aware of it or not, because whether he was or wasn't, if we're taking him at his word that he didn't know, and again, our reporting contradicts that, but if we're taking him at his word that he didn't know, well, what is he going to do about it now? And I think that's the big question.
Well, you've just said so many things, including what is he going to do about it now? People are pointing out that this is a president who has expressed fondness for autocrats like President Putin. Why, you know, isn't he saying something now about the possibility that American soldiers not just were targeted, but reporting that some might have been killed?
That's right.
Because of this Russian bounty offered to the Taliban. You also said that this is a president that the aides feel may not want to win the next term. Talk more about that, because we're also hearing when he disses the idea of voting by mail. Some people are now saying that they feel that's a president seeding the way for failure. In other words, if he does lose, he can point to this and say that's why. Talk about maybe not even wanting to win.
Yeah, so two things I think can be true at once, right? My colleague Annie Carney and I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago, just that the president's level of self-sabotage was making a number of advisors inside and outside the White House question whether he is serious about trying to win again. The things he does on Twitter are a form of self-cutting, for lack of a better way of putting it. He has been warned repeatedly that he needs to change the way he's behaving or he is going to lose. And his response has been, well, I have to be myself. And then he grudgingly sounds as if he's understanding it. And then, you know, a few hours later, tweets something else incredibly inflammatory. He has been in trouble since March and April when he was doing those coronavirus task force briefings at the White House podium. And they just turned into a form of anger therapy for him, where he would scream at reporters and he would yell about how unfairly he was being treated. In the middle of a pandemic, I don't think people are particularly concerned with how hurt his feelings are. But I think, look, regardless of what he says, most people around him will admit that he did not think he was going to win in 2016. And because he didn't think he was going to win, or at least in part because he didn't think he was going to win, he didn't spend a ton of time thinking about what the job would look like, which is part of why he had that kind of stricken look on his face when he was sitting with President Obama in the Oval Office during the transition. I think that four more years does not sound great to him. I think he's tired. I think he doesn't particularly know what he wants to do with a second term. And I think that he has, to your question about voting, what he has done is set up villains to blame if he loses. He did that in 2016, too. He called the election that he won rigged, even after the fact. So it's just sort of important to bear that in mind.
You mentioned, you know, maybe he doesn't know what to do in the second term. Here he is talking last week to Sean Hannity, a friend on Fox News, with a softball question. What are your top priority items for a second term?
Well, one of the things that will be really great, you know, the word experience is still good. I always say talent is more important than experience. I've always said that. But the word experience is a very important word. It's in a very important meaning. I never did this before. I never slept over in Washington. I was in Washington, I think, 17 times. All of a sudden, I'm president of the United States. You know the story.
As you know, Maggie Haberman, lip-syncing comic Sarah Cooper immediately made a tape of her voicing the president's words. The president seeming to try to go to the strategy from 2016, which is, you know, I have no experience, which was a good thing then because he was positioning himself as an outsider who's going to change things. Then it sounds like as he's saying this, he wants to pivot away because do you think Americans want someone without experience now?
What he was saying was that he now has experience. That is true. He now has experience literally of being in the Oval Office. But what he didn't have experience with was how you react to a crisis that wasn't of your own making. And that's what we saw with the coronavirus and the economic collapse. So what I was most struck by in that clip was not whether people want someone with experience now, although certainly Joe Biden would argue that he has more extensive and more relevant experience than Donald Trump had or has. It was amazing to me just watching him be kind of unable to answer this question that, as you noted, was a softball. This was a friendly question by a friendly interviewer that if there had been 5 minutes of prep, he should have been able to answer. And he just couldn't. And it just digressed into something about John Bolton being an idiot and all this other stuff, which is fine, but has nothing to do with the second term.
I mean, so, people want to hear, going to shepherd a vaccine. I'm going to get this economy back on its feet. I'm going to get people back to work. You're talking to people that surround the president. Some of us are left to just wonder how it must feel to be a president who weeks ago was the one encouraging states to open up and Florida, Texas followed suit. And now we have the spike in very ill people in those areas. History will show this as a president who encouraged people to take risks and risk their lives. And we have some clear demonstrations of how, for instance, masks have been politicized. There is a video that's just taken off of a woman in a California Trader Joe's refusing to wear a mask. The workers are trying to escort her out. Let's listen to a little.
This is day one. This is opening day of Trader Joe's in North Hollywood. This is Karen.
Maggie, are the people around the president having to sort of end run him to do the right thing on the coronavirus pandemic?
I think that the president has become something of a non-entity, frankly, in dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. I don't even know that I would call it an end run. I think he is surrounded by people in the White House, and really just there's a very small handful of them. I think that most of them realize that work needs to be done and they're just going to go ahead and do it without him. So in other words, I don't think that it's so much sort of sneaking around behind him. I think it is just recognizing that there is something that has to take place and they're going to make that their focus. Mike Pence is still in charge of the coronavirus task force. The president made a dramatic show of not wanting to end the task force when we reported a few weeks ago that that was the discussion, and it was. At the time, the president, I think, was not that involved in the discussion. What I think is amazing is how much of this government goes on in spite of the president, not reactive to him, not tiptoeing around him. But I think the coronavirus has become a piece of that because, look, to your point, history is going to show that this is a president who played down the impact of the virus, the severity of the virus, and at every opportunity, that he tried to bend public sentiment to his will, that starting in the end of March and the beginning of April, he tried getting people to rebel against the social distancing measures by tweeting things like liberate Virginia or liberate Michigan or liberate this state or liberate that state. And it didn't work. What happened from that time, and there's been some change in the last couple of weeks, but in the weeks immediately after him doing that, the public support for the lockdowns increased. People are scared, and he has been unable to change that.
That's New York Times White House reporter Maggie Haberman with her view of what is going on in the Trump White House at this moment. Maggie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says his country needs a new deal to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, which has killed more than 43,000 people in the UK. Johnson told Times Radio today that the government should approach recovery like President Franklin Roosevelt did during America's Great Depression.
The country's gone through a profound shock, but in those moments you have the opportunity to change and to do things better.
Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. Rob, good to speak with you.
Very nice to be with you, Peter.
And what do you think the Prime Minister means exactly when he talks about a new deal in the UK?
Well, the short answer to your question, Peter, is we simply don't know. But I think it's very difficult to interpret it as anything other a promise by the UK government to splash vast quantities of cash. Now, I think that is going to be, of course, news to some in the governing Conservative Party, because, of course, many Conservatives thought particularly of Brexit as this fantastic opportunity, as they would see it, of a low tax, low regulation economy, something more like the United States, not some sort of giant case of state intervention. But I guess Mr. Johnson is going to be arguing that COVID has changed all of that.
Right. If that came from a conservative politician in the United States, I think people here would also be taking a second look. The United Kingdom, predictions are that the economy will be down by more than 11% this year. So, how bad are conditions there, economically speaking?
It feels as though it's a hammer blow that's about to fall. And why it hasn't fallen yet is that the UK government instituted fairly quickly after the virus hit this thing called a furlough scheme, which is a word familiar to people in the US, but nobody in the UK had heard of it before. And it basically means for those businesses that just couldn't operate as a result of the virus, the government would pick up the wage bill. I mean, as simple, as big, as drastic as that. Now, that scheme is going to start tapering out as of next month and is supposed to finish altogether in October. And I think that is when economists are predicting the really nasty stuff is going to happen. And the nasty stuff meaning unemployment on a truly massive scale.
Hmm. What's the situation right now with opening up? Are bars, restaurants, businesses back in operation?
July the 4th is the big day here in the UK. It's a date familiar to you all, of course. It's the end of lockdown, as some right-wing newspapers have described it. Glorious July 4th. Independence Day. I mean, of course, a lot of the police forces around the country are wondering whether it was an entirely smart idea to reopen pubs and restaurants on a Saturday, given how we Brits love to eat, drink, shop, and all that kind of stuff. But I think it is being seen as a key moment. Now, look, whether people actually do go out to restaurants and bars and pubs and start to go to sort of things like, I don't know, outdoor cultural events, we'll see. Because interestingly, a couple of weeks ago, non-essential stores were allowed to open. So it had been previously supermarkets buying food, that kind of thing. A couple of weeks ago, you could go out and do other frivolous stuff, like get yourself some new shoes and clothes. And after an initial burst where everyone thought was so fed up of being in their own homes, they went out to the shops, things look pretty quiet to me, certainly now here in London and where I live about 60 miles away in Oxford.
That's the BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Thanks as always, Rob. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
And we reported here when Quaker Oats, now owned by PepsiCo, announced that it would be dropping its Aunt Jemima brand in this Black Lives Matter moment. You know, the happy black face on the box of pancake mix, telegraphing warmth and comfort food. Here's a 1959 ad.
Yes, simple and delicious. Just fry pieces of bulk pork sausage, shake up a batch of Aunt Jemima's, then pour the batter on the griddle and sprinkle with drained sausage meat. Light, tender, Aunt Jemima's.
But critics have long said the character, originally played by a former slave at the World's Fair in 1893 and then by various black women who dressed the part in places like Disneyland, this character was a white romantic notion of the antebellum mammy, having nothing to do with the real cruelties of slavery. But now, descendants of Lillian Richard, who was one of those brand ambassadors back in 1925, are unhappy about Quaker Oats' move, and what they see is erasing their relative's legacy. Vera Harris is Lillian Richard's niece. She joins us now from Forney, Texas. And Vera, just tell us what you thought when you heard about, you know, getting rid of Aunt Jemima.
The first thing I thought was I truly understood because of the Black Lives Matter movement, and which I support. But I also thought that my erasing my Aunt Lillian Richard would erase a part of history, a part of history that her family, as well as the town of Hawkins, where she came from, you would be erasing all of that history because all of the people in my family are happy and proud of Aunt Lillian and what she accomplished.
There's an historical marker dedicated to her in Hawkins, Texas. She made a career during a time when black women had very few opportunities. To talk about that.
Yes, she did. When she was 20 years old, she went to Dallas to look for work. Because back then, in the early 1900s, of course, most of the jobs for black women were domestic maids and cooks and stuff like that. And at the time, Quaker Oats discovered her and offered her the job to be one of the ambassadors.
At such a young age, what would she do? What did that mean to be an ambassador?
Oh, I think she was excited about it because first off, it was a job. And she would go around to give demonstrations at fairs and at stores and other public places.
Yeah. You know, this is so interesting because I have a family member who is black. And as a young kid, he just used to love the Aunt Jemima pancakes because he was a black child raised in a white family. And for him, this was something that telegraphed, real comfort from this beautiful black face on the box. But we know that the history is complicated. The inspiration came from a song called Old Aunt Jemima in 1889. These white pancake flour entrepreneurs decided to make that song the inspiration for their pancake mix. They hired a former slave, Nancy Green, commissioned to be that first face of Aunt Jemima. She'd also travel the country wearing an apron and a bandana. The criticism has long been this is an idealized, white, romanticized version because slavery, you know, certainly was not kind to blacks and black women. Look, elsewhere in the show, we talk about another controversy that African-Americans are divided over. It's a Lincoln statue with a slave at Lincoln's knees. Some blacks wince when they see it. But the descendants of that slave or former slave take it as a matter of pride. Here you are, you and your family, taking Aunt Jemima as a matter of pride. What could be a possible solution for you?
I would hope, and my family would hope, that they would come up with a commemorative box. Maybe they could have on the back of the box a list of all the previous ladies that portrayed her. Once a month, maybe have one of the ladies featured on the back. Most certainly talk about my Aunt Lillian with a picture of her dressed up with the scarf on her head as well as the apron. And then a current picture of her so people would see what she really looked like, because she was an intelligent, young, vital, beautiful Black woman that took the job. She understood the times and that she lived in, and she just wanted to work. So when as a little child, when I found out about that, because that was never a secret, we were always told about Angel Mama, and my parents are buried near her. So we would like to continue to celebrate her legacy.
Maybe if the box also explained why it was of some controversy, having nothing to do with your aunt. I mean, the other fact is your aunt and other Black women helped build Quaker Oats.
That is correct. They sure did. And for that, I think Quaker Oaks owe them a large gratitude of thanks. I just think that Quaker Oaks moved without maybe consulting some of the families, because we most certainly they didn't reach out to us. We reached out to them. And, you know, just let them know we would like to preserve her legacy.
Well, Vera Harris, again, the niece of Lillian Richard, one of the 12 women who became brand ambassadors for Aunt Jemima's in 1925, traveling the country dressed as the character, who don't want that legacy erased. They want people to know Aunt Jemima was, in many cases, a real person. Vera, keep us posted on, you know, what happens next. Thank you so much for talking to us about this.
I sure will. Thank you very much.
By the way, in 2015, a petition was started to replace Aunt Jemima with the image of Black entrepreneur B. Smith, who passed away earlier this year. Quaker Oats says it will announce a new logo and name. Stay tuned. Meanwhile, doctors are still discovering new symptoms related to the coronavirus, but one of the weirdest we've heard is something called COVID toe. Its connection to the coronavirus is a mystery. Researchers are trying to solve it. David Hyde from member station KUOW has more.
Christine Jensen is a legislative analyst with King County in Washington State. And back in early April,
I had a couple of red spots on my feet and on one of my hands that were inflamed and kind of tender to the touch.
When those symptoms didn't go away, she went to her dermatologist over Zoom.
I had to try to take pictures with my cell phone with good lighting and, you know, at the awkward angle of trying to photograph your own foot. It was a bit challenging.
Once they sorted that out,
we had talked about how in the month of March, I had what seemed like possibly some flu-like symptoms for about a week and a half.
Her doctor said there might be a connection to the coronavirus.
That definitely started to trigger a little bit of alarm for me.
Dr. Andrea Calouse is Jensen's dermatologist, and she's seen a few patients with COVID toe symptoms, which can also affect the fingers.
They can be itchy, they can be painful, they can go from being like a red-purple spot to turning into a blister, and the skin can even sort of fall off the top.
How do dermatologists know that this skin condition that's being called COVID toe is really connected to the coronavirus?
Unfortunately, we can't answer that yet.
Calouse is collaborating on a COVID toe research project with the rheumatology department at the University of Washington. It turns out COVID toe looks a lot like a condition called chilblains.
It's usually a cold and damp environment that kind of triggers this reaction in toes. And so people who are in the Northwest, this actually isn't a super uncommon thing.
That means if you think you have COVID toe, it could be because you're wandering around the house in bare feet, which a lot of people are doing these days while working from home. But Dr. Calouse says this could be different.
We're absolutely seeing this in numbers we have not seen previously.
The other big factor, chilblains, involve inflammation of the small blood vessels in your skin. And that's similar to more serious inflammation that's likely caused by COVID-19. Some young kids, for example, are getting a condition which can affect the heart's arteries. But here's the strange thing. Most people with COVID toe don't test positive for the disease. Dr. Calouse says that's one of the things researchers at the University of Washington are puzzling over. It could be that the COVID tests aren't looking for all the right markers of this disease at the optimal time.
Maybe we look at particular proteins that are present in the virus, and that might be a different way for looking for the virus that's not detected in those other kinds of testing that we've been doing.
At the same time researchers are learning about COVID-19, they're also trying to learn from the virus. Dr. Jane Buckner is a rheumatologist and president of the Benaroya Research Institute. She sees a number of patients with lupus and other rare diseases who also get chilblains.
The majority of people who've gotten it over the years, we've never known why.
But the concept that it's been triggered by a virus is pretty likely.
So what about Christine Jensen, the woman with a suspected case of COVID toe? Tests to see if she'd had the disease came back negative.
Now everything has cleared up, probably lasted just shy of a month.
But her dermatologist, Dr. Kalous, still suspects this and other cases she's seen may be connected to the coronavirus, even though researchers haven't yet figured out how. For Here and Now, I'm David Hyde in Seattle.
The Federal Election Commission is once again unable to regulate campaign finance laws months ahead of the presidential election. Republican Commissioner Caroline Hunter resigned last week, leaving the panel without the necessary quorum to do business, which includes a backlog of hundreds of investigations. One of the remaining commissioners joins me now, Democrat Ellen Weintraub. Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. And the commission, once again, has no quorum. So what does that mean in terms of what you can do with the FEC, or better yet, what you can't do without a quorum?
Yes. Well, we've still got a week. My colleague announced her resignation on Friday and gave us 1 week's notice. So I'm sure we'll be very busy this week. But it's a problem when we don't have a quorum. The FEC is supposed to have six commissioners. We haven't had six for years, but it requires four to make most of our important decisions, to launch investigations, to conclude investigations, to issue any fines, to conduct rulemakings, to issue advisory opinions, to provide any solid information about the state of the law, really. We need four votes. We can continue to provide information about who is supporting which candidates, the databases, the information that we collect from candidates and from PACs and party committees about where their money's coming from and what they're spending it on. That will continue to be filed. That will continue to be on our website. That will continue to be analyzed. But there is a lot that the commission is really disabled from doing if it doesn't have a quorum.
Well, on very important issues as well, we're seeing that dozens of cases that you will not be able to act on involve potential foreign interference in U.S. elections. Tell me about that and whether or not we should be concerned that this will be an issue in 2020.
Well, yes, I'm certainly concerned. And that is just one aspect of our caseload. We have currently over 350 cases on our enforcement docket, and there are almost 250 decisions on those cases and other matters that were awaiting the arrival of the chairman, the last commissioner who brought us back to quorum just a couple of weeks ago. So we had quite a lot of work to do even then. Of those, over 70 cases involved recommendations from our staff that we do something, that we move forward. There are a lot of decisions that are uncontroversial and easy, but there are some that are important and require thought. Included within the 350-some-odd cases are, as you say, dozens of cases involving allegations that the foreign national prohibition has been violated. There are allegations that people are making contributions in the name of another, that they're funneling contributions through dark money groups, that people are not filing their reports properly so that the public is not getting the information that the Supreme Court says they are absolutely entitled to and need to have in order to have an informed electorate in the upcoming election. So, yes, we have many important decisions. There are areas of the law that require clarification that we cannot clarify without four commissioners, and it's a big problem.
Another issue is the security of mail-in ballots this year in particular because people are voting remotely because of the pandemic. I want to play some tape from Attorney General William Barr, who told NPR last week that he believes wide-scale mail-in ballot use is insecure and open to counterfeit schemes by foreign actors.
And there's so many occasions for fraud there that cannot be policed. I think it would be very bad. But one of the things I mentioned was the possibility of counterfeiting.
Do you agree mail-in ballots are unsafe?
No. And let me be clear that that aspect of election administration is handled at the state and local level, but I have looked into this, and there are numerous studies that have looked into this. Even the people who are trying to prove the existence of voter fraud can only find a smattering of instances over decades out of billions of votes cast. It is just not substantiated that there is a big risk that's associated with mail-in votes. And I worry that by government officials putting out information like that, they're going to discourage people from voting. I want to see every eligible citizen in this election have the opportunity to vote and to vote safely. And this year, that's going to mean that a lot of people are going to want to vote by mail. Whether states choose to encourage that or not, voters are going to demand it. And this is going to require a lot of resources. And states and localities, like other aspects of our economy, are really hurting right now. So the federal government, Congress, needs to step up and provide more funding.
So considering everything that you've just told me, how concerned should we be as a country that the day after Election Day, 2020, we can be confident that the election went smoothly and fairly?
Well, I don't want to make any predictions. And I also think that people need to be prepared for the fact that they may not know the day after the election what all the results are. The ultimate goal has got to be we have got to pull together as a country to demand that we have accessible and safe voting for every eligible citizen. We can do it if we are committed and we start now.
Federal Election Commissioner Ellen Weintraub, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Robin, hold on to your hat for November. It's going to be interesting. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I always wear my hat during broadcasting. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.